hur vi kan förverkliga oss själva på 101 000 olika sätt, det skapar ju förvirring och det skapar ju någonstans lätt kanske en dålig självkänsla kring att nej, men jag borde egentligen göra det här också.
If everybody's chasing perfection, then even though it's unhealthy, and even though chasing perfection ourselves will make us no more likely to succeed or be happy, we feel compelled to do it.
When I grew up in the 60s and 70s, there were no fancy clothes for 8-year-olds. Now fashion starts at 4, you know. It's much earlier everything.
Välkommen till andra delen av Perfektionsfällan. Veckans avsnitt där vi undersöker det här med att allting ska vara så perfekt och vad det kan göra med oss och om det verkligen alltid är det smartaste sättet att leva på. Det här är Hälsorevolutionen och jag är Carina Lundstedt, poddens producent, författare och förläggare. Och i förra delen, del 1 i uppsnacket, så undersökte vi hur kraven på perfektion ser ut i våra liv, Marias och mitt liv. Och nu kommer jag lämna över till Maria, för nu har vi fått besök av veckans gäst, författaren och forskaren Thomas Curran.
Ja, hej, jag heter Maria Borelius, är vetenskapsjournalist och biolog. Och idag har vi alltså Thomas Curran här med oss. Thomas, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you are a psychologist and associate professor in the Department of Psychology and Behavioral Sciences at London School of Economics. And you have written The Perfection Trap in English, Perfektionsfällan, att omfamna kraften i lagom bra. What is The Perfection Trap?
Well, The Perfection Trap is really a title to describe a kind of psychology where we simply never feel like we're ever enough. And perfectionism really is encapsulate that psychology very neatly. It's about trying to reach for excessively high goals, goals which are lofty and unattainable. And in the process of trying to reach those goals, we exhaust ourselves and feel a lot of distress and dissatisfaction because we never quite get there. It's like chasing the horizon, you know, the closer we get, the further it moves from our reach. And that's the trap of perfectionism. It's really about unattainable standards that simply don't allow us to feel content.
We have in this program started something. So we start off the programs by just from the gut, 3 words to describe how you feel today. How are you today? When you come into the studio?
Today I'm feeling happy. I'm feeling very refreshed. I got a very good night's sleep the last couple of nights. I have a young child at home and not getting much sleep, so refreshed.
So coming to Sweden is like a holiday for you.
It is a little bit, yeah. I miss my partner and my child very, very much, but I do feel refreshed having slept a couple of nights.
Yeah, yeah.
And just excited to get the word out about this book. I'm speaking to a lot of people and it's clear that the book's message is landing really well in Sweden with the people and journalists I'm talking to. So I'm just really excited to get this message over here in Sweden.
Okay. Great. So I have my 3 words, I think right now, are a little bit tired. It's the end of the week. I've worked very hard. I am content on a deep level because I get to work with stuff I love, like meeting you, talk about things that I find are important. And my 3rd word today is a little busy. I have a lot on the plate today. So those are my 3 words.
Awesome.
It's good.
Yeah.
We know a little bit about where we come into the room today.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. I get a feeling when I've read your very thoughtful, beautiful, personal, smart book that you are writing this book to your younger self. What do you say to that?
I would say that there's a lot of truth in that statement. I certainly have struggled with perfectionism myself. It's the reason I do this research. And when I was asked to write the book, there was 2 ways I could have gone. I could have gone down the more traditional route whereby I would list the studies one by one, talk about what they mean and their implications, and then maybe make a few conclusions about what the overall state of play in the literature is. Or I could go back to the reason I actually did this work in the first place and really introspect on the feelings and behaviors and thought process that that were at the root of my own perfectionism and at the root of many people's perfectionism. And so I chose that route because I thought, you know, the only way that I could write a book that I think connected with people is to write a book that connected with me. And so that's why I center myself, but not just myself, other people in my environment, my own stories, my own experiences, and the things that I saw all around me, to try to capture perfectionism in its most, I suppose, intimate sense, in a way that you can't really get across if you just look at the data. Because I think, you know, perfectionism is really about feelings. It's really about love, the root of it, you know, the sense that we're searching for something we can never find in ourselves. And that, a lot of that is very...
You mean
very
love in the sense of external validation.
External validation.
Other people loving us, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and it's really difficult to communicate that through numbers. But you can communicate that through words, and you can communicate that through experiences. And so that was really the reason why I centered myself and my own experiences in the book and tried to explain perfectionism through that lens.
You talk beautifully about your background in a smaller British town, your grandfather, who was a carpenter.
Yes.
And who worked very lovingly with his woodworks. So tell us about your background.
Yes.
Yeah, so you are now at one of the most prestigious universities in Europe, but that wasn't a given, given your background.
No, it wasn't a given. And I never envisaged in a million years that I would be sitting here talking to you, a professor at LSE, writing a book. I mean, all these things are very surreal. I grew up in a small working class town. Actually, our biggest industry was, alongside construction, shoes. So Doc Martens is a big factory.
Doc Martens?
Yes, where I grew up. It was the next village over. Unfortunately, they outsourced their manufacturing.
I'm immediately looking at your shoes. And you have kind of, you have gone to the dark side. You're Adidas today.
Do you know what? I have a couple of pairs of Doc Martens, and they would have been suitable in this sort of weather. But the problem is, when you're traveling, they're so big.
They are very big. So you're traveling with a couple of very neat Adidas sneakers.
I am, yes, today. I've tried to travel quite light. But that was our industry. And but, you know, manufacturing's outsourced in the sort of 80s and 90s, and towns like mine were left behind, sadly. So it wasn't the most affluent of upbringings. We didn't have a great deal, but there was a lot of love and a lot of appreciation for working with the hands. And that was something that captivated me as a young child, watching my father and my grandfather working, just making stuff. Particularly my grandfather was a master craftsman in the area, and he wasn't a very good businessman, unfortunately, but was an exceptionally good craftsman. And he'd just make tables, chairs, window frames, bar stools, all sorts of everyday things, you know, just for other people to use. And what's really heartwarming is when you go to the pubs around the local areas, some of his woodwork is still there. Like,
wow, it's stood the test of time.
Yeah. And that's, you know, sometimes myself and my dad and my brother and my mum will go there and just kind of appreciate this part of him that's still there. Something quite nice about that. But yeah, it was full of difficult experiences too, you know, because those sorts of industries were on the decline. It wasn't easy all the time for my grandfather and my father to get work. There was struggle as well.
Yeah, there was struggle.
So my upbringing was very simple in those terms, but surrounded by a lot of creativity and love.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com.
Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Den här veckan så fortsätter vi vårt roliga sponsrade samarbete med Skinome, färsk hudvård. Produkter helt utan konserveringsmedel och andra onödiga tillsatser. Det här är ett svenskt hudvårdsföretag grundat av hudforskaren Dr. Johanna Gillbro. Och idag ska vi fortsätta prata om Skinomes innovativa solskyddsprodukter, eller hur Maria?
Ja, vi gillar ju båda att njuta av solen, liksom de flesta svenskarna. Solen är ju inte bara en källa till glädje och värme och ljus. Den är ju också vår främsta naturliga källa till D-vitamin, och det mår vi ju bra av. Och som alla vet kan för mycket solexponering medföra risker på grund av solens ultravioletta strålar, det vi kallar UV-strålning. Vi vet hur viktigt det är att skydda huden på bästa sätt. Och både Carina och jag har börjat använda Skinomes solskydd Sun Emulsion.
Ja, vår sponsor Skinome erbjuder 2 solskydd med olika solskyddsfaktor. Dels Sun Emulsion SPF 50+, och så den senaste nyheten Sun Emulsion SPF 30. Och båda de här ansiktsprodukterna går att använda som enda dagkräm om man vill, då de också innehåller både vårdande och återfuktande ingredienser samt prebiotika som stärker ditt mikrobiom.
Tänk på att applicera rikligt med solkräm just i ansiktet. Förutom att stärka skyddet mot cancer så kan du också minska risken för UV-inducerade ålderstecken. Och då talar vi om rynkor, pigmentfläckar och brustna blodkärl. Skinomes senaste nyhet, Sun Emulsion Solskyddsfaktor 30, innehåller också en innovativ ingrediens från den svenska västkusten. Vi talar om algika som tillverkas just av alger. Studier visar att algika förstärker den solskyddande effekten av UV-filter och skyddar huden mot miljörelaterade luftföroreningar.
Ja, det här är innovativt. Skinomes solkrämer passar både barn och vuxna, även de med känslig hud. Om du blir osäker på om du ska ha solskyddsfaktor 50 eller 30, så kan du gå in på Skinomes hemsida och göra deras solskyddstest. Just nu så kan du prova Skinomes solskydd och övriga hudvårdsprodukter extra förmånligt. Med koden Hälsorevolutionen 20 så får du 20% rabatt under april månad. Rabatten gäller inte på redan nedsatta varor. Gå in på skinome.com och beställ den nya generationen solskydd.
Carina and I talked before about the internal. I told her it's almost like a German World War II officer standing inside me telling me what to do, which is terrible really. Yeah. But your internal perfectionist, what does that look like? Does this person have?
Well, a lot of shame. I think
it's shame.
Growing up with less than other people, the thing is you're only it's stupid stuff, right? Mm. Like pencil cases, trainers, backpacks. Phones, gadgets, these are all stupid things, are stuff. But when you don't have them and you're a child, consumer culture has a really nasty way of teaching you that there's something wrong with you, that for some reason you aren't able to have the things that other people have, and then therefore there must be something wrong with you. So I felt a lot of shame growing up that I didn't match up, that I didn't have the things that other people had, and that I couldn't express my personality in the ways that other people could express their personalities.
How did this shame manifest itself inside of you? Where did it sit in the body?
It's a really good question. It felt like it came very deep. Like when you would go to school, it would almost be like you're being stabbed. Like when you have to admit that you don't have that, or like, you know, oh, are you getting this? Oh, I don't have it. And it was like every single time it was like another little stab and of shame.
When you say stab, you pull almost towards the heart.
Yeah, a little, well, more in the pit more of the stomach. Right. Yeah. It was like because I wanted so much to be able to just be like everybody else and have the things that everybody else had. But it, it wasn't the case. And I wasn't the only one. There were a lot of kids in our school who were also didn't have a great deal either. We, you know, we, as I said, we come from a very poor town, but some kids did. And the kids that did were able to be, you know, the run of the playground sort of thing. And you looked up to them and you just wanted desperately to be like that. And then, of course, we got older and cars came onto the picture and didn't have one of those either. So, you know, that kind of shame of just sitting in the back seat, not being able to go anywhere, not having the freedom that they had. Yeah. It was maybe humiliating a little bit, maybe a bit embarrassing. I think we live in a world now where, and it was only like getting older when you look back and reflect on this, that was no fault of anyone's, no fault of mine, no fault of the people who were flaunting their gadgets and toys and cars. That was just the fault of the consumer culture that we all live in, that teaches us that there's something wrong, that if we don't have a certain look, a certain way, have a certain lifestyle, that there must be something wrong with us.
Our human value is connected to the things we have.
Absolutely.
Instead of our being, yeah.
Absolutely. And and as a young kid, you can't know that. You can't work that out
no,
in your head.
It's intrinsic,
so,
yeah.
So you just take it on yourself.
Yeah. It's funny. I wonder if that has grown a lot, because I feel the culture is becoming more and more materialistic. You know, when I grew up in the 60s and 70s, there were no fancy clothes for 8-year-olds. And when I was 12, I mean, who had fancy clothes? Because you couldn't even buy them. There was no fashion for 12-year-olds.
Mm.
We all had the same clothes. Mm. Because now fashion starts at 4, you know. It's much earlier, everything.
And
yeah,
just a bewildering aware choice, yeah, as well. I mean, just go to a shop for something as simple as a pair of socks, and you're just bombarded with choice after choice after choice. It has become crazy. And of course, you know, reflecting on those early experiences of that shame led me on to introspecting on consumer culture, which then led me on to thinking about our obsessive need to have more, do more, be more, and which is encapsulated in the amount of choice that you're talking about that today we see. It's definitely a cultural phenomenon, I think, this yearning for more, and it's not feeling never enough. And as we've just discussed, that's something that I think, for me, was setting a trend very early in my life.
But you, on a personal level, use that, or the feeling of shame in your stomach is transformed into a need to perform and wanting to, you know, you have built a fantastic academic career for you, who I guess a lot of other psychologists would think is the result of very, very hard work, which I guess it is, such as writing this book. So how did you start using perfectionism as a way of softening the feelings of shame?
Well, perfectionism is really, if you want to get at the nub of it, an escape from ourselves. It's essentially a glistening cruise liner that promises to take us across the gulf between the imperfect person that we are, that person that harbors these shame-based fears about not being enough, and this idealized perfect person that we want to be, that we feel like we should be, that society tells us we should be. That's what perfectionism really is at its root. And that's how I use perfectionism to try to overcome those early feelings of not being enough. As soon as I realized that I could take up a place at university, it was clear then that I had an opportunity to elevate myself, lift myself above other people. And I took that very seriously, worked extremely hard, got myself a master.
Why do you laugh? Do you feel ashamed about having those thoughts, or?
Because when I look back, that I can see quite clearly the moment that perfectionism took over. I could see it, just you know, it's almost like a spark that sets off that this is now, because, you know, it's also about opportunity. You have, one of the things I'm often asked, but isn't the perfectionism important to where you are today? And I'd say, yes, of course it is. But the thing is, it's like Gladwell writes in his book Outliers, there's so many other factors to success. And I was also extremely lucky. Yes, I was a perfectionist, but I was very lucky. I came through in a time when our government, we had a Labour government time led by Tony Blair, was funding people like me to go to university. If I'd been born a year later, the Conservatives came in, austerity was enacted, they cut the funding, I wouldn't have gone. You know, these are moments in time where you think you're so fortunate to have got over the line at a certain time. But it was that opportunity that I was given that then set off in train this spark. And the reason why I laugh is because I can see very clearly that, you know, there's an opportunity. I was able to go to university, and now suddenly I thought, well, I've got to seize this opportunity. Mm. Like, I can lift myself out now. Mm. And what I didn't realize is quite how tough that journey was going to be.
Mm. Mm.
And quite how much perfectionism I need to use.
Mm. It's true for, I guess, all your colleagues at London School of Economics and everywhere else where you have a very, very high performing people. They probably have an internal little German officer or, sorry, Germany, similar in themselves. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
You start off by, in your book, talking about the dream of physical perfection. And I think in that sense, we can all see what's happening right now with Instagram, you know, where influencers have to take 197 pictures to pick out one that is good enough.
Yeah.
So most of the things we see there is just augmented reality. It's not reality. It's something else that wants to look like reality.
Mm.
And you talk about a woman with a mole, very beautiful woman with a mole.
Yeah.
And the mole becomes the whole thing.
Yeah, the birthmark. It's a very famous story, horror story. Interestingly, you know, back in Jacksonian America, perfection and perfectionism was the stuff of Gothic horror. You know, this idea that we would shoot for perfection in our lives and lifestyles was something that, you know, the sting in the tail of these books was, or these short stories, was that, you know, perfection ultimately drains life from us.
Mm.
And the two characters in the short stories that I feature in the start of the book, but in particular this first character, who is a young, beautiful lady, but whose beauty was marred by a birthmark. The story is essentially that her and her husband tried to correct this birthmark at all costs, and they managed to concoct a compound of chemicals that she took that removed the birthmark, but it also killed her.
Mm.
And the lesson there was that, you know, this is completely an absurd way to live, and that ultimately it takes away what's joyous about us and lives, which is our imperfections.
Mm.
A remarkable story, but not one that we necessarily heed today.
No.
In the era of social media, as you mentioned, because we're constantly competing with each other to try to create a perfection in our lives and lifestyles through, as you say, airbrushing, filtering, creating backdrops and all the rest of it, so that we can project into the world. And again, this goes to this projection of what we're trying to project into the world, of these perfect lives and lifestyles. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, this has to be the starting point for the book. It has to be, because this is the era we live in today.
If I want to be the devil's advocate, you could say that what's wrong with, in everyday life, looking for a bit of inspiration on Instagram on how to do your makeup or how to cook a beautiful meal or how to do a nice trip, or is it wrong?
No. and look, there's nothing wrong at all with seeking out ideas and looking for ways to live that will enrich and enliven your life. There's nothing wrong with that at all. And in fact, that's what social media should be used for. It could be used for.
Mm.
It could be a tool to enlighten us, to inspire us, to cement offline relationships. That, by the way, that was what was originally for, right? To connect college communities. All of these things are immensely powerful for things that social media can do for us. But the problem is, the incentive structure for social media companies is not to inspire and educate and inform and create community. It's to capture our attention and spending.
Make money. Make a lot of money.
And so that incentive structure then turns social media into something else.
Mm-hmm.
About mimic rivalry. About creating an aura of discontent into which targeted advertising can thrive. About keeping people online by fomenting polarization and hate, unfortunately.
Couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
Hijacking our neural, our old brain.
Yeah.
And the way it looks for rewards in the dopamine system, or all of these things, I think we are seeing it's spinning. It's spinning right now.
Yeah, I truly believe that if we were just left alone to use social media for what we want to use it for, we would do the things that you talked about, you know, helping each other and showing each other how to do things that help and enliven our lives. But we are not in charge of how the algorithms work, sadly. And
well, if the product is free, we are the product also.
Exactly.
So this we have to just be very aware of. I think another very good example of how the chase for perfectionism can actually backlash is you talking about doping, because it's so clear what it's all about. Lance Armstrong, the very famous cyclist who won, how many medals was it?
Seven Tour de France,
yeah. Enormously physically exerting. And he, of course, confessed to having doped himself with Oprah Winfrey in a very famous interview. Shall we listen to that a little bit?
Let's do it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Let's start with the questions that people around the world have been waiting for you to answer. And for now, I'd just like a yes or no. Did you ever take banned substances to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
In all seven of your Tour de France victories, did you ever take banned substances or blood dope?
Yes.
In your opinion, was it humanly possible to win the Tour de France without doping? Seven times in a row.
Not in my opinion.
Yeah, that was Lance Armstrong, the world famous cyclist, confessing to having doped himself. So why do you use the example of doping?
It serves two purposes, I think. It's a really nice metaphor on two fronts. The first is that it helped Lance, clearly. He won seven Tour de France titles. Mm. He was able to become the most celebrated and decorated cyclist of that era. Mm. And off the back of that, had a glistening career, not just in the sport itself, but in broadcasting, and did a lot of good in his charity work as well. He was a huge public figure. And so his drive and desire to win at all costs, and all costs being doping, you know, incredible risk to his health.
And a feeling, I think, also that all his colleagues were doing it anyhow. I mean, there is this feeling that, you know, everybody's doing it, so why shouldn't I do it?
He basically went with the crowd in that respect and sacrificed his body and his health to win. Mm. You know, it's a very perfectionistic way of thinking that it's a win at all costs. It's that failure is not an option. But interestingly, at the end of this story, in the interview we just heard there with Oprah Winfrey, is that it came crashing down. Mm. Because ultimately, you know, there was some point that win of all costs mentality was going to creep back and bite him in the backside, so to speak. So that's one of the conclusions from the Lance Armstrong story, that it's an unsustainable, perfectionism really is an unsustainable way to strive, and at some point it's gonna catch up with us. But the other implication of the story is something interesting you just touched on there, was that the reason why Lance Armstrong said he doped was for the reason you said, because everybody else was doping. And so that for me was the moment in the interview where I already sat there and thought, okay, that's really interesting, because if everybody else was doping, then doping gave no one cyclist any more chance of winning, right? But at the same time, imperiled each of their health. This was a completely stupid thing to do in an aggregate sense.
For all of them.
At the individual level, maybe it made sense. But if everybody did it, then nobody gets the advantage. And I think this really says a lot about our obsession with perfection in broadest culture. That if everybody's chasing perfection, then even though it's unhealthy, and even though chasing perfection ourselves will make us no more likely to succeed or be happy, we feel compelled to do it. Mm-hmm. And so Lance's story is interesting in two respects, in terms of how this will always come back and hurt us ultimately. But because of the cultures and because of the systems and because everybody else is chasing that golden ticket to success. And if everybody's chasing perfection, nobody wins.
Yeah. So as a biologist, you know, I think it's very interesting with effects that stress have on our body. Mm. And in the pod here, we like to talk about the sympathetic nervous system as our squirrel, and the parasympathetic nervous system as our panda. I love animals, so yeah. I think it's a good metaphor. And of course, we get a lot of shit done in the squirrel. Mm-hmm. But we also need the yin and the yang. We need the panda to repair, restore, reflect, all of those things which are about healing ourselves. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Lance Armstrong is an ultimate example of a super squirrel. Doping is doing yourself into a super squirrel.
Yes.
It's really doing only that. But what effects can we see on the body and on the mind of this constant stress that perfectionism leads to?
Well, that's where I had to center my own story, because we can talk about the literature and we can tell the boring story, which is basically that there are very strong correlations between perfectionism and mental health outcomes. You know,
I don't think it's boring at all. I think it's super important.
It is important, but these are just correlations, right?
Yeah.
So we have very strong correlations, stronger than most other personality characteristics on things like depression, anxiety, mood disorders. You have very strong correlations, self-presentational disorders, things like bulimia, self-harm. Very strong correlations to things like ruminative cognitions and worries about how we're presenting to other people. So many strong correlations between perfectionism and very negative mental health outcomes.
Let me then just explain here. So the difference between a correlation and a cause. So a correlation is that we see these things occurring at the same time.
That's right.
And the cause is that we can say that A gives B.
That's right.
Yeah. So in your mind as a psychologist, do you think they are just correlations, or do you think some of them are causal effects? If you speculate.
Well, that's why we need to give the deeper explanation of what's happening, because these correlations, just as you mentioned, should tell a link, but they don't say what's going on. They don't help us understand why it is that perfectionism has those correlations. And it could be causal or it could be spurious. We don't know. But a lot of the work that we've been doing by tracking these things over time seems to suggest that perfectionism does drive the car of a lot of my mental health problems. But what I wanted to do in the book was to talk about actually why that is. And that, 'cause I think that's more important than just telling the story of what's going on.
Yeah, well, I would disagree with you there, very politely.
Yeah, sure.
Because I think in a culture where you can also say we get a lot of stuff done in the squirrel, and I don't want to have a nurse who isn't a perfectionist with my morphine dose. Mm-hmm. I want to go to a dentist who is a super perfectionist when it comes to setting my dental blockage.
Yeah.
Like I want to be on the millimeter right. It's also important to explain what it does to the wider health issues.
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so I think one of the things we have to recognize is that perfectionism is very different to conscientiousness, to diligence, to meticulousness. I absolutely want my dentist who's doing a very important piece of surgery on a very sensitive area of my body to be meticulous.
Yeah.
I want them to be diligent and I want them to be conscientious. But I'm not sure I want them to be perfectionistic. And the reason is because perfectionists really struggle under situations of stress and challenge. They find it very difficult to get past the worry about what's going wrong and focus on how to put things right in that moment. I'll give you an example. When perfectionists come under stressful situations, we do this in the lab a lot. We give them tasks, public speaking, cognitive tasks like puzzles, or give them an athletic task. And we tell them that they didn't make it, they failed, or something went wrong. Every single time, the perfectionistic people will respond with intense amounts of self-conscious emotions. They feel a lot of shame, as we mentioned, a lot of guilt, a lot of embarrassment, a lot of worry. And their reaction is not to work harder to put things right, if we ask them to have another go, for example, but is instead to do the complete opposite and to withdraw themselves from the situation. Stress is too intense that they're going to...
They block themselves.
They block themselves.
The perfectionist blocks performance. Is that your thinking?
Yes, they completely self-sabotage, because the imperative is to avoid failure, not to approach success. So when I am having this surgery, I want somebody who can respond to stressful situations adaptively, who can think very clearly about the checklist, who can understand that there are many good enough ways to get ourselves out of this situation, but no perfect way. And the challenge is to decide which is the most optimal, good enough way. And so, yes, I think there are qualities of perfectionistic people that are certainly very positive. But if you put them in challenging situations, that equation changes. And so that is why I wouldn't necessarily want a perfectionistic
person. Okay, I think it's a very good distinction you make.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I'm thinking when you are saying this, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm thinking if you have in a team... We do a lot of things in teams in our society. You have one person who is the perfectionist there. That strive for doing no mistakes is going to block everyone else too in the group of even thinking aloud, what if we tried this? What if we, you know, listen to this person instead? It's going to make everybody afraid of just stepping out of the circle, so to say, especially if the perfectionist is the boss.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's 100%. And we see this all the time. We see this all the time in the data. If you create cultures of perfectionism, we call them perfectionistic climates, then that cascades downwards onto members of staff who feel more reluctant to put their hand up, perhaps when they made a mistake, or speak openly about issues or quarrels that are occurring within teams. Now, those things are super important.
But then can I ask you?
Yes.
We've got a media culture with journalists looking at politicians, looking at captains of business, looking at leading academics, pop stars, everyone who is in the public arena, going down very hard on them making any mistake. What does that do to innovation, creativity around those people?
It's completely terrible. It's completely terrible. But you'll notice, particularly in the UK, I don't know what it's like in Sweden, but you'll notice who is permitted to be imperfect and who is not. And it depends on political persuasions, where they come from, as to which side of the fence the media will fall. If you are, let's say in the UK, for instance, if you are left wing, if you're a socialist, you are not permitted to make a single mistake, put a single foot wrong, and you will be excommunicated very quickly if you do. If you are on perhaps the conservative side of the equation, which is the dominant side of the political spectrum in the UK right now, then you can make the odd mistake. In fact, we've seen very high profile examples of British politicians, and I'm sure you may have seen the stories in Sweden, who have made many, 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 many mistakes and became prime minister. So I think we have to bear that in mind too.
Are we talking about people who don't know how many children they have?
Maybe. Possibly. So we have to also be aware that this is a function of a power and where power is concentrated. But to your broader point, It isn't a good thing at all that what we tend to have today is a very blame culture. We don't do much explaining. We don't try and understand why it was that people made mistakes. What were the factors? What were the incentive structures? Why was it that these things occurred? It's somebody or something has to be to blame. And it doesn't really matter about what went on behind that. And I think that's really problematic, because that means that people in the public eye, politicians, will never accept in interviews that they were wrong. You will never see a politician public.
Because you just get punished for it.
Because exactly.
Rather than being a place to start something new or do a U-turn or reflect on what you've done and learn from it. Yeah.
100%. And that's a problem of the media, I think. I really do. I think if we were a little bit kinder to people who have very difficult jobs and explain the circumstances behind the mistakes, I think we would be in a way better place. But we have a very defensive ecosystem where politicians cannot accept blame, and I think that leads to more mistakes, not less.
Very good. Okay, we have now bought your entire premise that perfection leads to blockage, leads to actually less good work and more unhappy humans. What can we do to resist if we can see this in our lives? And I was talking to Karina before, you know, I'm a perfectionist in certain areas, not in others. I have a husband who is a perfectionist in certain areas, not in others. It's very easy for me to see the perfectionist in him, more painful to see it in myself, but it's there. So how do I resist?
And this is really common. We will all have areas of our life. Remember I talked about earlier, perfectionism being this idealized image that we want other people to see. And that will be different for everybody. I want people to see the perfect, erudite, bulletproof professor who can stand up in front of hundreds of people and give a flawless lecture. You know, and I want to be across all the detail, and I want to make sure that any question I get, I give a rounded and comprehensive answer to. That's my idealized image of myself.
That's Thomas 2.0.
Exactly. And everybody will have their own version of that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And where are you not a perfectionist?
I would say that I can let things go a little bit easier in leisure activities, like, let's say, football.
You don't have to be, you know, Wayne Rooney?
I don't know.
No, no.
I can kick a ball very badly and be okay with that.
Yeah.
Music as well. You know, I play guitar. I used to play in a band. I haven't played for years because I just thought I wasn't a world champion at it and my perfectionism just held me back. But now I can play and feel the joy and connection that comes from that and actually feel the release of the perfectionism in that act. So there are definitely areas in my life where I've picked up and post my rehabilitation from perfectionism have really just thrown myself into to enjoy, knowing that actually being bad at something is really liberating when it comes to perfectionism. And allowing yourself to be bad is really liberating.
Well, or you're using a word which I like, good enough.
Yes.
You don't have to be bad. You're just in the gray zone.
Well, this is right. You're absolutely right. When I say you're absolutely right, you start bad.
Yeah.
But over time, if you allow yourself to throw yourself into these activities, then you become good, right? Now, you're not going to become perfect, or you're maybe not going to be Dave Grohl. You're not going to stand in front of an arena of thousands of people at Wembley Stadium. That's not going to happen. But it does mean that you get better, and that mastery and that competence and the sense of satisfaction that you feel from improving is so important. It's the most important thing in terms of our well-being, is that we have a sense of purpose and we feel like we're making strides. So, you know, going back to your question about what can we do, well, I think that's a very important first step, is to throw ourselves into areas of our lives that we perhaps wouldn't because we feel afraid, or we feel like people are going to see. And that's not easy. I don't have a quick like life hack fix.
No, but I think it's a very good point. And let me give a practical example. I started bodybuilding when I was 52. I'm 63 now. And a lot of women who need to build muscle at that age, because we lose muscle, are so perfectionist in the gym that they won't even go into the gym because they feel they're not good enough. And you have a lot of very muscular, quite aggressive, hypertrophy young men who are lifting very heavy weights by the mirrors, etc. So we block ourselves. We don't even go in there. But I allowed for myself to be a little bit better than bad and just start and just went. And now, I mean, I'm not Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I do find my way really well around the gym. I'm super self-reliant, I know. And I've just allowed myself to kind of climb on the ladder in the gray. Not black, not white, in the gray. Yeah. Is that a good picture?
100%. That's such a good example.
Being a non-perfectionist.
That is such a good example.
Because it gives you time to also improve.
Yeah.
Very softly.
But that couldn't have been easy at first, right? That might have been,
First, I felt very, and I had a trainer online who sent me programs, and I looked just sternly into my phone.
Yeah.
And had big earphones on, and I just shut, because I thought everyone was looking at me, because at the perfectionist spot, we are kind of in our ego a lot too. Yes. Yeah. And I felt ashamed of myself and everything. And then I said, no, I need to be here for my health.
Yeah.
And I think in a simple way, is it an illustration of what you're talking about?
100%. That is such a powerful illustration. And I think it's really important for people to know that this isn't, you know, you're not going to just waltz into the gym and feel completely comfortable and at home, because your perfectionism will always tell you that somebody's watching. And they're judging you.
But they're all, then you realize everyone is busy with themselves.
Exactly.
No one is watching. And no one is even interested that you're there. It's all about your own thoughts.
And in a world of perfectionism, everyone else is feeling the same thing.
Yeah, so I think that this gym thing is like a very good metaphor.
Huge. Yeah, it's a really good metaphor.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's such a powerful example. And I mean, the example in my own life is just picking up the guitar again and just playing, because, you know, I used to think I suck. And I thought, well, I can't show people that. I can't go to open mics and just do what I love, because people are just going to think I'm not very good. And it's just about getting out of your comfort zone. As I say, it's not going to be easy. And you have to be vulnerable, and you have to be willing to be vulnerable, and you have to be willing to go through the anxiety and discomfort that putting yourself out into the world is going to create, because it's going to create a lot of it. But you have to always remember at all times that you're brave enough to put yourself into the world, and so therefore you have to be kind to yourself when you encounter those difficulties, because it's not going to go well all the time. You know, if you're at the gym, you might find that on one occasion you just lifted maybe a little bit too heavy weight and it didn't go quite as well as you wanted it to, and maybe you need some help or whatever, these things that your perfectionists would be like, oh my god, you couldn't show that vulnerability. But actually, you learn a lot through that process that actually it's okay. It's not as catastrophic as you think it is in your head.
No. And you become an inspiration to other people.
That's right.
Which is very interesting. At the gym I went at the time, I had a gentleman who had had a stroke who came in anyhow. And he had a very hard time walking, had a leg that was limp, a hand that was limp. And everyone could see that he was, in his own way, working on his grayscale. And he made everybody better in the gym. Mm. We all got inspired from him. Mm. Not from the best guy, but from him.
Yeah.
Everyone was looking. I mean, you could see people shining when they were looking at him.
Yeah.
He was like a beacon for all of us. You know, we were thinking, if he can come here after this stroke, I can be here and do my best. I learned a lot from that experience.
And I think there's something incredibly liberating, actually, about people showing up. And Brené Brown.
Yeah, showing up. Yeah. Brené Brown has said, yeah, show up.
She talks a lot about this. I think she's so right. And actually, one of the most humanizing things is to just go out there with all of ourselves and all of our feelings into the world. And people see that. And they recognize that there's something, there's a common humanity in those experiences that really brings us closer to other people. One of the things that really brings me closer to audiences is when I, particularly academic audiences, is when I just accept that I made mistakes in papers and data analysis and things in the past where, you know, you look back and you're like, oh my God, like, how could I have been so stupid? But actually, these are just part and parcel of developing and growing as an academic. You don't do things perfectly all the time. And if you just are vulnerable enough with an audience to say, yeah, well, you know, this didn't go well, or that didn't go well, you can almost see a sea of relief that people can see that this person is human, just like me. Mm. So there's something very powerful about showing up, about vulnerability. And I think it's because there's something common about those experiences that we feel so repressed in ourselves. Do you know
what I mean? Bridge. It's the bridge.
And now suddenly somebody's given us permission to release it. And I just think there's something really powerful about that. Mm.
Finally, this sort of idea that you had really made me think a lot, because you're quite skeptical about the idea of constantly growing as human beings. Mm. Not only the economy, which you talked a little bit about, but also asking of ourselves to constantly grow psychologically. And you cite Barack Obama, the former American president, as he asked of some school children, he said to them, do not let past mistakes define you, but try to learn from them. Why is that the wrong way to approach it, in your opinion?
Well, there's nothing wrong with learning from mistakes. I think the first part of that quote is perfectly acceptable and very, very good, noble advice. But it's the second part. You can't let your failures define. You have to let them in some way teach. You have to let them in some way help you to continue to move forward. I think what this teaches us is that there's something deeply shameful, actually, about mistakes and failures. That we can't just let them sit there as part and parcel of our humanity. And we can't just accept that sometimes in life, there is nothing to learn. We just screwed up. We just turned, you know, we had a bad night's sleep. You know, our kids woke us in the middle of the night and we turned up to work completely exhausted. There's nothing to learn in those situations. And by the way, these are situations that we experience hundreds and hundreds of times. Across days, weeks, years. You know, these are just very common humanizing experiences of slipping up and hitting setbacks. Of course, there's a time for learning and there's a time for development and there's a time for growth. I'm not saying that these things aren't important, but what I am saying is that sometimes it's okay to just fail. Mm. And it's okay to let those experiences into our lives and sit next to them, not needing to repress them, not needing to recycle them constantly into growth. How can I use this as a growth opportunity? But to actually just reflect on, this is what it means to be a human being. And in an imperfect world. And I think we have to be really careful, because this focus on growth and growth and growth at all costs has become something of a cliche, has become something of an imperative that every single human being must now adhere to. And all I'm trying to say in my very gentle pushback against that focus is that life is not perfect. people are not perfect. We are exhaustible human beings. And instead of seeing mistakes, failures, and setbacks as things to always develop and grow from, instead seeing them as things that are part and parcel of our common humanity. And that doesn't mean we can't grow, but that just means being a bit more reflective about what those failures and mistakes mean.
Thomas Curran, who has written the beautiful new book, Perfektionsfällan, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Denna vecka har vi ett betalt samarbete med Bosch som precis har kommit ut med sin nya köksmaskin serie 6. Och jag har ju alltid älskat att baka och har tänkt att jag vill baka lite oftare eftersom det gör mig så glad. Och nu har jag hittat ett sätt som gör det både enklare och smidigare.
Vad kul! Och vad ska du baka för något?
Ja, men igår så testade jag att baka bananbröd som jag gillar väldigt mycket eftersom det även är ganska hälsosamt. Jag hade i valnötter och inte så mycket socker som det står i receptet. Och först tänkte jag att det skulle vara krångligt att baka med en bakmaskin, för det har jag aldrig gjort innan. Och jag skulle sätta ihop olika delar, trodde jag. Men så var det inte, utan jag känner redan att serie 6 är en pålitlig vän i köket, för det var faktiskt väldigt enkelt.
Ja, vi är ju lite lika där, Karina. Tycker ibland att det är jobbigt med för mycket bruksanvisningar av teknisk karaktär, men den här gången var det kul.
Ja, Bosch serie 6 är en väldigt snygg och cool köksmaskin, bara en sån sak. Den levereras ihopsatt och det är inte svårt att förstå hur man ska komma igång. Jag håller fortfarande på att utforska alla funktioner och automatiska program. Bland annat så har den smarta sensorer som gör bakningen enklare genom att den känner av när det du bakar har perfekt konsistens. Och därtill så har den en unik 3D-mixning som efterliknar handknådning och fångar upp alla ingredienser så att inget lämnas kvar i botten av skålen, vilket ju kan vara irriterande annars. Ja, jag får återkomma lite närmare till just den funktionen när jag bakar bröd nästa gång. Eller om jag ska baka kanelbullar, det var ju länge sedan.
Jag vet ju, det gillar ju du, det är ju väldigt gott. Och det här med 3D-mixningen låter ju väldigt spännande. Hur ofta funderar man inte på om degen verkligen blir genomarbetad när det står knåda väl i receptet, eller hur?
Ja, precis. Och för mig är det viktigt att det är enkelt att lyckas med bakningen för att jag ska liksom dra igång ett bakprojekt. Och jag tycker att serie 6 gör bakningen ännu mer lustfylld genom att den är så enkel att hantera.
Det gäller bara att välja program och sen kan man luta sig tillbaka medan maskinen gör jobbet. Eller varför inte fixa köket medan degen knådas?
Låter perfekt. Bors nya serie 6 finns att köpa redan nu hos Power. Och där kan man även få mer info om köksmaskinen. Och vi återkommer snart med mer inspiration och berättar hur det går med Carinas vårbakning. Ja, det var Thomas Curran. Det här är väl intressant, Carina?
Ja, alltså wow. Det här talar till mig till 100%. Vi lever ju i ett sånt prestationssamhälle där vi hela tiden kan göra lite till, lite till, lite till. Mm. Någonting. Och det, alltså, den mänskliga drivkraften är ju bra i grunden. Att vi vill åstadkomma förändring och göra bra saker för oss själva och för varandra. Men idag med alla oändliga val vi har att tillgå, alla möjliga vägar och hur vi kan förverkliga oss själva på 101,000 olika sätt. Det skapar ju förvirring och det skapar ju någonstans lätt kanske en dålig självkänsla kring att nej, men jag borde egentligen göra det här också. Och det kan vara allt från vad man har med sig hemifrån till hur man ser att någon granne klipper gräset kanske ännu mer.
Gräset är perfekt. Grönare på andra sidan.
Ja, ja, men det är inte alltid det behöver vara så perfekt klippt kanske. Nej. Ja, nej, jag känner att det här är så viktigt och så sant att vi liksom, ja, som du sa tidigare, att man liksom chillar lite ibland.
Man chillar lite.
Och barnen säger ju det så himla klokt. Chilla mamma.
Ja. Nej, och jag tänker också på det här för att man ska själv reflektera lite grann kring dig och mig. Vi gör ju en podd som handlar om att lära sig av saker, att växa som människa. Och jag tänker att det är väldigt viktigt för oss också och för du som lyssnar att bara också ibland tänka, nej, ibland kanske jag inte orkar lära mig något. Mm. Det är bara, I just fucked up, eller det blev en dålig situation. Liksom man behöver inte alltid vara på hugget och framåtlutad, utan ibland får man bara låta axlarna sjunka ner och säga, ja, ibland är livet jättekonstigt.
Jag jobbade på en tidning i början av min journalistkarriär på tidningen Expressen. Och där var man väldigt så här, då gick man vidare. Det blev ju vissa misstag i denna tidning som ibland uppmärksammades. Och då sa ofta cheferna så här att nu är det en ny dag, nu är det en ny tidning. Och gårdagens tidning var ju noll värd, för den hade ju kanske någon slagit in fisk i, var liksom ett sånt där uttryck. Så den, ja. Och du är aldrig bättre än din senaste tidning, eller det kan vara din senaste bok, eller din senaste mötesdragning. Så att alltså förmågan att gå vidare och inte gräva sig, liksom hålla sig fast i eventuella misstag och analysera, det kan ju vara sunt, eller hur?
Mycket, mycket bra. Så jag tycker det här, och jag tror att den här killen, han sitter ju och har mängder med studenter som är liksom toppbetyg, jätteframåtlutade, gör varje uppgift 57 gånger om och så vidare. Mm. Så det här budskapet kommer ju väldigt rätt i vår tid. Och det är ju inte bara toppstudenter på LSI. Alla försöker vara toppstudenter på allt nu i livet. Och människor är rädda för att åldras och cyklar 5 mil om dagen och så vidare. Alltså det är liksom över hela linjen. Mm. Så att lite av det här bara att chilla.
Mm. Luta sig tillbaka.
Chillaxa.
Det kommer ordna sig till
slut. Det kommer ordna sig till slut. Precis. Tack för att du lyssnar på Hälsorevolutionen. Vi är så tacksamma att vi får hänga med dig. Hör gärna av dig om du vill fråga om någonting, kommentera. Vad har du för tankar om perfektion?
Vi finns på Instagram där vi heter halsrevolutionen_podcast. Och vi har även en Gmail-låda som jag kollar lite för sällan. Jag ber om ursäkt för det och ska snart svara i kapp. Och då är adressen halsrevolutionenpodcast@gmail.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.